I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. The EEOC at page 13 of its brief concedes the three-factor approach to the partnership issue.
Well, you know, before you get into that, what I found surprising in your brief and also in your opponent's brief, I didn't say anything about the purpose for exempting partners from the discrimination laws. And usually, the interpretation of a legal concept like partnership is influenced by the purpose for which the, you know, classification is being made. So you want to address that?
Certainly. The purpose is the very different situation a partner finds himself or herself in. Unlimited personal liability for mistakes. If Sidley and Austin caused the Enron disaster, every single Sidley partner would be at personal risk for their fortune.
Why is that relevant to discrimination?
It's relevant to discrimination because it's relevant to having outside entities determine who's going to be your partner. It's a value judgment that has to be made. Partners should be able to decide who is going to be their partner, who is not going to be their partner.
Can't bring a discrimination suit for being turned down for partnership on racial or...
Of course you can.
Then the outside agency is choosing your partners. I don't understand.
The outside agency is choosing who becomes your partner,
right.
But it's not choosing...
That's critical, because that partner can subject you to unlimited liability. So I don't know what you're driving at.
What I'm driving at is that the partnership relationship is far different from an employee relationship.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It doesn't look much different here, I must say.
My income as a partner is going to depend on how hard partner Easterbrook works.
That's true in a regular company. Look, if you look at Wall Street, they're all corporations now, but half the compensation of the, you know, the investment bankers and securities analysts and like often half their compensation is based on is a bonus, and it's very heavily influenced by the profits of the company as a whole. So the fact that employees share in profits is nothing.
I think the most important point is made by the Tenth Circuit in Wheeler, which is that if Congress wishes, if the discrimination law should be extended to cover partnerships, the legislative branch should do it, so that the legislative branch can set specific rules.
You're not tracking with my concern. The question is, what is a partnership, or what is a partner really, because obviously Sidley has elements of a partnership, what's a partner in terms of the purposes of the discrimination laws? What are the indicia of a person's employment status that are important from the standpoint of having an exemption from the discrimination? Now, the profit sharing business, the fact you get your income is influenced by the overall profits of the firm, that seems to me the least of your points. And the other one, the management, is zero. And then there's this ownership. So yes, they make a capital contribution, I suppose. Do they borrow that, or they actually?
Well, there's no dispute, Judge Posner. No, they don't borrow it. They pay it. They pay it, and they have an ownership interest in build times and
not just deducted
billing.
From their wage.
There are two elements to the capital contribution. The first is the minimum balance. That's cash. That's paid. The second is because partners own the firm. Nobody owns Sidley and Austin except its partners.
Well, I think the executive committee owns the firm. Actually, if you want to be realistic, now maybe we should be formalistic. But if we were realistic, the executive committee owns the firm, and they hire people, and some of them they call employees, some of them they call partners. They hire them, they fire them, they set their wages. They assign them to committees, other drudgery. They make them put up money when they're called partners. And these so-called partners, they never, except for the Brown and Wood acquisition, they never vote on any. They have no control over their fate or over the firm. So I think you make an argument that realistically, this firm is owned by the executive committee, and whether the other people are called partners, employees, secretaries, they don't have anything that realistically is like an ownership interest.
This is the domination theory. The executive committee dominates.
You can call it what you want.
Three points on
what's wrong with it?
What's wrong with it?
Don't just trot out a bunch of district court cases. What, from the standpoint of protecting people from discrimination, what is it about these people that distinguishes them, say, from a senior associate at the firm?
Well, let me answer by means of a hypothetical. I leave Paul Hastings with 9 other partners and 20 associates. I form a nice little law firm. 10 partners, 20 associates. We all share profits. We all contribute capital. Joe heads litigation. Sally heads corporate. Pete heads new business. And we have to decide what's going to happen if there's a dispute between the partners. Who makes the final decision if a partner doesn't like what Pete's committee decides? And they said, let's avoid acrimony. Paul, we trust you. We'll have you do it. You be the czar. You make the final decision. Does that destroy partnership status, our classic professional partnership? Of course not. No case has ever held that the act of delegation to a committee, a final decision if there are disagreements, is anything other than an act of a delegation of management partner power by a true partnership. Sidley and Austin, for over a century, has chosen this means of governance. Some of the most outstanding lawyers in the country have joined it as partners.
Your view is that a dictator, you have a plebiscitary dictatorship, you have a dictator elected by a democratic vote, you know, like a Hitler or Napoleon, something like that, then it's not a dictatorship, it's a democracy.
I'm saying the partners...
So if a bunch of partners get together and say, we don't want to have anything to do with this business, we want you, the kingpin, we want you to fire us, hire us, tell us what we're paid, tell us what to do. And you're saying that's still a partnership.
Absolutely. That's the method of governance that Sidley and Austin has chosen and has chosen for over 100 years. Every partner that joins Sidley and Austin chooses that method of governance, signs the partnership agreement, and says, I like it, and it works.
I mean, 100 years ago, there was an executive committee and the other partners didn't vote?
For 100 years, every
I
Sidley...
I doubt that.
For
how
over
large
100,
was Sidley and Austin 100 years ago?
For over 100 years.
How large was Sidley and Austin 100 years ago?
A lot smaller, but for over 100... Pardon? To answer your
how
question...
How large was it?
How large was Sidley 100 years ago? Carter, you know?
You have no idea. So don't talk about the governance structure 100 years ago.
Okay, the point is that for decades, the governance status has been exactly as it is. Every partner to join Sidley and Austin signed up because they liked that governance structure. That is an exercise of true partnership to choose the governance structure.
They signed up because the combination of things they were getting, including earnings opportunities, was attractive to them. Of course, they might have thought the governance structure was a terrible thing that went with good earnings opportunities. It doesn't seem to me that your argument depends in any way on whether they liked the governance structure or whether they suffered the governance structure as the price of getting something else they liked.
But they chose the complete package, which included a 25-committee governance structure, an office chair structure, and a committee structure. The EEOC, in its brief at page 13, concedes that the law established in every circuit to consider the issue has found that partnerships, rightly or wrongly, aren't covered. Maybe it's wrong, maybe it's right, but a true partnership isn't covered by the discrimination laws. That's a given.
That's the whole question, though. I mean, the other thing the EEOC has been saying is that at some point, pegging the label partner on somebody shouldn't be enough to exempt them from the discrimination laws. And the whole issue here is, where's that line? Is it at a 50% guaranteed salary and 50% profit sharing? Is it a 25-75? Is it a 80-20, and they're saying we need the information about Sidley and Austin, most importantly, to come to a rational decision about how that line
they have that gone. Information. Wherever the line is, Sidley exceeds it. The information they have on profit sharing on the 32 partners is that compensation went from $200,000 to $650,000, average $350,000. 80% of that was pure profit sharing, dividing units into year-end profits and distributing them. They have that information. And wherever the line is, it is exceeded by 80% pure profit sharing.
Why don't you just offer to stipulate everything the EEOC wants to learn? And if I understand, the EEOC wants to show that Sidley is organized as a kind of consensual dictatorship by by deciding to be a Sidley partner rather than somebody else's partner, you've agreed that the executive committee will rule your life. You've agreed that the executive committee can have the lion's share if it wants, as long as it's in office. Why don't you stipulate all of these things?
We do. The executive committee has final say. They have the partnership agreement. If there's a dispute, the executive committee decides. We have a committee structure and the like, but you say, why don't we give them what they want? What they want is what they're not entitled to. They want to know why we picked the 32, why we picked Jones. Well, we picked Jones because his lifelong best friend, the general counsel of XYZ Company, called us up and said, confidentially, we're going to fire you unless you give us another client partner.
There are two separate questions here. One question is, what information would enable us to determine whether Sidley is a partnership? And as Judge Posner said, the EEOC may think that its simple size and the degree of control and profit concentration in the management committee is important to that. Second question is whether, if it is not a partnership, these people were fired, demoted, whatever, for lawful reasons. Part of the problem in this case is the EEOC has refused to unbundle those two things in its subpoena.
Correct.
It wants to ask both of them at once.
It wants to know why we picked Jones.
You, of course, could have forced the issue more clearly by offering as a written admission everything that the EEOC might want to hear about the partnership organization, and then resisted only on such questions as why was any one of these 32 picked.
That's precisely what we did, Judge Easterbrook. I personally invited the EEOC time and time again, tell me anything you need on the partnership issue and we'll give it to you. Answer, we aren't talking to you. We want everything. We want the merits. The EEOC's district court papers...
So you're claiming to have complied fully with every part of the subpoena that asks for information relevant to the coverage issue.
Precisely.
Right.
That's the EEOC's weakest point.
But
what subpoenaed facts could possibly make a difference?
But no, there's another issue, which is whether the EEOC at this stage of the game, at the investigatory stage, is actually entitled to investigate both the coverage issue and the merits issue, because
the
subpoena certainly does ask for everything, and
right.
There are some cases in which a dual track like that has gone on, and your position has been they're not even titled to gather everything all together and then see if they want to file some sort of proceeding against you. I'm not sure that the law is strongly on your side on that.
Let's start with the factual prerequisite of the argument and then get to the law. The factual prerequisite is Judge Posner focused on. Did we give them everything? The answer is yes.
Not everything in the subpoena. The subpoena has 9 categories of things. You certainly did not give them everything.
We gave them everything on the partnership issue. I'd like to list what they said in their brief. We didn't
I know what they didn't give you. I just am concerned about your position that you are entitled at this stage of the game not to conduct merits production.
Mm-hmm. I have to establish the prerequisite to my argument. 4 things they said in their brief they asked for and didn't get. 1, complete compensation information on every partner, despite the fact that they have it on the 32 and in disgusting detail showing that 80% is pure profit sharing. 2nd,
you didn't comply fully. I don't understand.
We complied fully with respect to everything that could possibly relate to the partnership.
That's
issue.
Very different, and that wasn't the question. The question was, did you answer all the questions that in their perhaps benighted thinking were directed at the coverage issue? And the answer is no.
The answer
you have
is
only
yes.
Let me finish. You keep interrupting it.
Sorry.
The only questions you've answered are the questions you thought were pertinent. They have a different view of what's pertinent.
But let's look at their view. They said 4 things. You gave us thousands of things, but you didn't give us 4. You didn't give us complete compensation information on all partners. You didn't give us performance information on all partners because we want to figure out whether profit sharing is fair. 3rd, you didn't give us the process of selecting the 32, which is undisputed. The executive committee did it. And 4th, you didn't tell us why partners other than the 32 left, which is obviously irrelevant to the partnership issue. I've fly-specked their brief. Those are the only 4 things they said we didn't give them, and they are irrelevant on their face. I will reserve.
Well, why is the complete compensation information irrelevant on its face? I don't understand.
Because we gave it to the 32.
One possible theory of why this isn't a real partnership for or why these people are not real partners for purposes of these, you know, the age discrimination law, is profit concentration in the management committee. So the EEOC wants to know, you know, is this management committee, the real ownership, taking the kind of slice that, say, shareholders would be getting of profits in a regular corporation?
We gave that to them, Your Honor. They got it backwards below. They argued that the management committee received 80% of the profits. In fact, it's 17%. The 34 partners on the management committee, 10% of the partnership, received 17% of the profits.
So now are you saying you gave them the complete compensation information?
We gave them complete compensation information on the 32, showing average compensation.
Not on the 32, on the whole company.
We gave them complete profit sharing information on the cumulative income of the executive committee.
So your answer is no.
17%. We didn't give them. Partner Jones makes...
Okay, so you have not complied fully with a portion of the subpoena that's directed to the coverage issue.
The coverage issue relates to, is there bona fide profit sharing?
This is a good procedure you followed at all, because what you're saying, I think it's something judges are apt to be uncomfortable about, because what you... They send you this subpoena, forget about the discrimination part. They send you a subpoena about coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And what you ought to do, it seems to me, give them everything they ask for. If it's confidential, you know, it can be placed under seal. Give them everything. Then you can argue about what that adds up to. But instead, you make a judgment as to what parts of their request are relevant and refuse to furnish other information. It leaves me, for example, curious. What are these other facts that you're so eager to hide from us, and mightn't they, you know, actually bear on this coverage issue, maybe in a way we don't even quite understand, because this is a novel issue.
We asked them.
But why are you hiding it from them?
I'm not. We said again and again, in writing,
making
it's in the
it
record.
Public.
Ten different letters from me to the EEOC. Tell me anything else you need on the coverage issue, and I'll give it to you. And they refused to respond. They flat out refused. They said, we want to know why you asked Jones. We're not going to tell you what's coverage and what's not coverage. We gave them everything we thought was even arguable on
what
coverage.
What you thought was arguable, but not what they thought.
We asked them, what do you think? If we made a mistake, tell us. We met with them.
You told me that there is a body of information bearing on their minds on coverage, which you have refused to furnish.
In my mind, once you establish under the case law that every fiddly...
Yes, that's where we disagree.
But I asked them, if you disagree with me, tell me, what's relevant to coverage? And again and again and again, they refused. They refused in writing. They refused in a person-to-person meeting. They laid out no facts to the district court that the subpoena would produce that could be relevant on coverage. And they argue four facts that are clearly irrelevant on their face to the legal analysis in their brief to this court. Those four facts...
Thank you, Mr. Grossman.
Thank you.
Goldstein?
May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Goldstein, counsel for the EEOC. Your Honor, I want to make two points. The first about the posture of this case, and the second about the facts. On the first point, the district court in this case said it couldn't rule on the coverage issue at the subpoena enforcement stage because the question of whether any Sidley partner is more like an employee or an employer, which I think is the critical question, is really a factual dispute that's going to require weighing all the different factors. In fact, no court has ever...
What is it, in your view, that we need to know and don't know now?
On
the question whether Sidley and Austin is a partnership or an employer.
On the coverage question, what we need to know, first of all, a large part of our investigation relates not just to the demotion of the 32 partners, but also to the existence, if any, of a mandatory retirement policy. That hasn't been discussed at all.
But wait a minute. Because I'm concerned.
But that's what I'm saying. We have no information on that.
But the problem that I'm having is I'm interested in the extent to which the EEOC's position is we get to investigate the merits along with the coverage issue, because whether they have a mandatory retirement policy or not is of no moment. Suppose we're talking about a little firm that had 8 people in it. If they had a policy that was said you had to retire at age 50, I mean, they're below the threshold.
That's right.
And the laws do not speak to that. Now, perhaps partnership is a different way that one could be outside the coverage of the statute. But either way,
right,
the commission's doing 2 really different things. If you're standing here telling us that there are things you need to know about coverage that you don't know yet, I, at least for one, I thought that was what Judge Easterbrook was asking.
It is. That's
why
I'd like her to answer.
I don't want to know.
I am trying to answer
about the merits.
The answer you gave me is not related to my question. Would you answer my question?
Yes, I'd like to. We have no coverage information on any partners who have been subject to the mandatory retirement policy or are potentially subject. We know nothing about their pay.
Look,
we know nothing about their ownership.
I don't understand why any of that is relevant to the question whether Sidley and Austin is a partnership for purposes of Title VII. It is clear that it is an employer. It is clear that it has employees.
Mm-hmm.
It's got associates. It's
mm-hmm.
got secretaries and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know whether it is also a partnership, and then the partnership would have some partners. So the question I'm asking is, what more does the EEOC need to know whether, in its view, Sidley and Austin is a partnership, in addition to being an employer of some employees?
Well, we don't dispute that it's a partnership. I think what we're trying to look into is whether any Sidley partners are more like employees, and hence covered by the Act, or employers, and not. I think that's why some partners would not be.
Well, you need to know, then, information about the 32 people who were let go, because the question then is whether they were employees.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Right. And what more do you need to know about those 32?
But the point I was trying to make earlier, Your Honor.
What information do you need to know about those 32?
About the 32. What we need to know.
Or about others that bears on the 32 status. It doesn't have to be information personal.
But I would like to know what information the EEOC wants about these 32.
About the 32. We are seeking and we are trying to make obviously seeking merits information, and we don't deny that some of the information that we're seeking goes to the merits. As to coverage, we're seeking information like, we're trying to compare ownership interests so that we can weigh whether or not they're more like employers or employees.
Could you just be concrete and tell me what information you are in need
In paragraph.
Then you can tell me what legal rule makes that information.
We're looking at the capital accounts of. We're asking for information on the capital accounts of other partners.
Of the 32. I thought you had received all the information about the exact size of their capital accounts, how much they put in.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
What information are you seeking about the 32 employees?
Merits information.
Just merits information.
What about this accrual capital account business?
I
take it you agree that you've gotten all the information about the capital accounts of all 32.
Of the 32, yes.
Well, what about these liability accrual, their liability accrual accounts?
Yeah, some of them, it appears, and we're just making inferences from the partnership agreement, it appears that they never vested, which means that the accrual account, which is where the losses and profits were simply put
in. So is this an area where you want more information about their information about these particular 32 people?
We would need to know specifically. It's unclear from the partnership agreement exactly. It's not for some. It's not entirely clear at what point it would have vested. So we would need a little more.
You need a little more about them. Is there anything else on coverage that you need? Not necessarily about them, but that's relevant to your to whether they are partners.
On them, yes, we do. I think because the cases talk about weighing the different factors, we do need comparative data to weigh, for example, whether their ownership interest was a meaningful one or not. Sidley, with respect
what
to Matt,
what does that mean concretely?
If do they own do they own such a small fraction of the firm that it...
Yeah, but what does that mean concretely? Do you have in mind a rule? One of the points in Sidley and Austin's brief, and I think an important one, is that an institution like Sidley should be able to tell ex ante whether the discrimination law applies to these people who it thinks are partners. That it should not be in a position where, for years, not only is it at risk of litigation, but the EEOC won't tell it whether the EEOC has a view that it's a partnership or not.
We can't.
The business, well, but that's why I'm asking, what more information do you think is legally relevant? Now, you say, how large are these? And then that leads me to the legal rule. What legal rule is it you think matters here?
Well,
if you had in mind a rule that said something like, no one is a partner unless he has, you know, 0.5% capital interest in the thing, I could understand that, and Sidley could understand that, and then we could decide whether that was the law.
I can't do that, because and courts have not done that. They have the Serapian case that we cited says, look, there's no one key factor. You've got to look at them all. You've got to weigh them.
I was not asking you to recite back to me what courts have said. I was asking you, what is the position of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission?
Our position is that it's not like the example Judge Wood gave of 8 employees clearly not covered by the statute. There can't be such a clear rule. And that
Can't there be a rule? You know, the NLRB has had long problems with its jurisdictional coverage, and it resolved them by saying anything that ships more than 500,000 in interstate commerce is in, anything else is out. Because anything else is a terminal mess.
Mm-hmm.
The EEOC seems to be taking the terminal mess position. The EEOC doesn't know.
Well,
Sidley can't know. No one can know. And 15 years later, we'll kind of toss the dice and see.
Well, Your Honor,
that's not a very satisfactory position.
Well, I think it's consistent with what the Supreme Court said in the Darden case, where it was deciding the question of whether somebody's an independent contractor or an employee. And there it said, you've got to look at the factors, you've got to balance it. There was the Supreme Court did not set out a per se rule. Everybody on this side of the line is covered, everybody on this side isn't. And
but
I think this...
Yeah, the problem that I have with that really is exactly the predictability problem. It seems under the Commission's view, people float in and out of partnership status, bona fide partnership status, depending on what committee they happen to be on. And if somebody left the executive committee and went over to, you know, social affairs or whatever these committees are, then they transform from a partner to not a partner, or if they pay in an extra $200,000 into their capital account, maybe they become a partner when they weren't a partner before. And It seems to me a very unsatisfactory way of assessing one's legal liabilities, planning one's actions, as I certainly assume Sidley and other firms are. They are firms that are attempting to comply with the law.
Yeah. Well, I would say that we actually haven't made that determination. We haven't said that floating in and out of these committees means somebody is an employee versus not. What we're doing is just saying, look, there's enough here that we want to weigh these factors. It may turn out that we concluded...
But I can't see what extra information you need to do that now, right? It's agreed Sidley has some top heaviness in the structure. It's agreed that some partners have much bigger capital accounts than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple points. It may be the case that with the 32, we have a lot, if not most of the information that we need just on coverage. There's another aspect of our investigation, though, which hasn't, and that was what I was trying to explain with the mandatory retirement. There are a whole other group of partners that we have no information on that we also need to decide coverage on. But I think the larger point that I want to make is, even if it's a practical matter, let's say we decide, okay, we're just going to ask for what we think. Assume also that, I mean, it's our position that some of them are intertwined, but let's assume that they're not intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we think that some of these partners are actually covered as employees. What then? We can't conciliate. We can't go to court. Presumably then we would have to do another subpoena enforcement proceeding to ask for the merits, because we haven't found a violation.
I understand that, but of course that was in part the course we suggested in United Airlines might be required. Although it's true that an agency has a lot of discretion in issuing subpoenas, certainly probably more so than district judges managing discovery, subpoenas can't be unreasonably burdensome.
Right.
And a subpoena becomes unreasonably burdensome if it asks for a lot of detail that don't become relevant until some contingency has been satisfied, and the contingency may well not be satisfiable. And that would almost be the definition of a burdensome subpoena.
Well,
and the fact that the EEOC has, at least according to your adversary, refused even to discuss breaking up this subpoena into phases, so that first it decides whether there's some real risk of liability under Title VII or the ADEA, and then it moves to the more burdensome stuff.
Well, I would take issue.
Makes the subpoena look extortionate.
I would take issue. We have thought about it, and we have.
We have thought about it, but your adversary says you've refused to discuss it with him. Now, is that correct?
No, that's not. That is incorrect. We have discussed it, but in our view, first of all, we have coverage information. There is coverage information out there that we don't have that we need. Secondly, we
could you list that?
Sure. On pay. Paragraph 5 and 9D of the subpoena, we need, we don't have any pay information on, especially those partners subject to a mandatory retirement policy. On the ownership prongs, paragraph 5 and paragraph 9E, we don't have any information on the capital accounts of anybody subject to.
And you think you can't determine coverage vis-a-vis the 32 without this total picture of pay and capital accounts for every single alleged partner in the firm?
Well, let's say we could. What
well,
then? This is the problem. It's a weighing.
The what then is, then do it, right? Then the commission can make a decision
mm-hmm.
saying, we think, indeed,
mm-hmm.
they are a partnership, and
okay.
now we want the other information. Or not,
okay.
but they're not partners, and now we want the other information. And at that point, it would be very hard for a judge to say no. But with the commission in this position of studied refusal to make a decision and insistence on getting the merits information while refusing to make a decision on partnership, that's what makes the subpoena look particularly burdensome.
Well, what we've decided is, I mean, it's our view that we have to have some discretion here, is that we're trying to do an investigation in the most efficient, best way that we can. Now, let's say we find we say to Sidley, we think these people are covered. There's no. Then what? I mean, that's the problem. That's why we feel like.
Then you seek the merits information.
Then we seek
and
the merits.
Then Sidley would be deprived of its main line of argument. But so long as the EEOC says we refuse to tell you whether we think
mm-hmm.
these people were partners or not,
I'm sorry.
We don't have to, it's kind of. You know, putting your fingers up to your nose and saying, we just don't have to cooperate by even telling you our tentative view.
Well,
that's what makes things look particularly burdensome.
Well, first, I would say, Your Honor, that first of all, and I want to emphasize that there's a lot of coverage information we don't have. But secondly, it's our view that we have to have some discretion here, that we have to, that we've decided in the context of this case, there may be cases where we go just for coverage, especially a case like the example Judge Wood gave. We've just decided
to make... Another way that somebody who has had some experience with federal bureaucracies might understand this, however, is that the reason the commission isn't doing this is because the staff understands that if they go to the commissioners won't support them. The commissioners will rule that these 32 people are partners, and they'll end the investigation. And therefore, the staff is keeping this away from the commission so it can't make a decision, and it can pursue this investigation in the hope that Sidley, rather than turn over all this information, which it would rather not turn over, will settle. Right? That's another way of understanding what's going on here.
I would take issue. It's possible.
But you can avoid any such characterization by going to the commission and having the commission make a decision.
We can't. There's no. Your Honor, what we have to decide, if we find cause, then where there would be a vote would be on whether to sue. But we haven't. There's been no determination that there's been a violation of the Act because we don't have the merits information before us. That's the only context in which it could go to the commission as a whole. That's why we need that. There's simply there's no procedure to get it either to the commissioners or to a court.
That's the commission to figure out how to make this decision.
According to that, too, even my 8-person firm example, the commission could go out and investigate every single one of them in the United States. And say, you know, we're going to see whether you're complying with the various laws. Right, the staff could be out there investigating them. And before going to the commission, they could say, oh, well, you know, now that we've looked into everything, how many people, merits, we realize that there's no coverage, and so we're not taking it to the commission. And hopefully it wouldn't be abusive like that, but I'm just saying there's, under your theory, there is no way to prevent that.
There is a way, and I think that was said by this court in the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission case speaks to that, which is if there's a case that's ripe for review at the subpoena enforcement stage, then decide it. In a case like the example you gave of 8 employees where there's no factual dispute, that could be decided. And what was at issue in the Great Lakes case was a pure legal question.
It's kind of bizarre to say that what ends up happening is that the legal issue gets decided by a U.S. Court of Appeals, mm-hmm. with the EEOC never having made a decision. And in your view, it's legally impossible for the EEOC to make a decision. There's no way we can get the EEOC's input on this question. We can only get the view of its lawyers.
The commission has made a decision to investigate.
Yeah, but it hasn't made a decision that, in its view, even tentatively, these 32 people were employees rather than partners.
Well, I can tell you candidly, Your Honor, that if there was opposition from the commission, I would not be here today. As it happens in this case, the chairperson of our commission is acting as the general counsel because there's been no general counsel confirmed. So, as a practical matter, right now, there is a lot of input. I think our main point is just we want to be able to weigh the facts. There are coverage is necessarily a fact-specific question. We would like to be able to make that determination.
Yeah, but I hope you can sense at least my unease. Fact-specific is one thing. No legal rules is another.
Yeah.
What I want is a position in which there are legal rules, comprehensible legal rules,
yeah.
and we then go out and find the facts
and
apply those legal rules to those facts.
Yeah.
But the position you're taking is not only is it fact specific, there are no legal rules to apply to those facts when we get them.
There are. I mean, it's a balance.
We're just going to engage in the Caesar salad approach to litigation. We'll chop it up and toss it a little, and then something may happen.
Your Honor, I think I would. There is a legal rule, which is you consider these three factors, and I think we've had the point.
You're saying it's a standard; it's not a rule.
I'm sorry.
You're saying it's a standard.
Yeah.
So it's fact. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Goldstein. Thank you to both counsel. Your time had expired, Mr. Grossman. Next case.